How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How you doing?
Oh, you know, just bringing energy to the show.
Yes.
That's what I do.
Our noble warmonger or our noble warrior left a comment or what, how do you say, a review saying that we lacked energy and logic and we were too emotional. So, sorry. We can't be as exciting as Skyrim is.
Hey, I got the cheerleading squad coming in to cheer as we talk about murder right behind me.
Ooh, okay? Exactly.
It's
energy. And
for
God
you.
Forbid we start laughing and we don't get emotional when people die. That's, yeah, well, whatever. Next time we're going to laugh. And then he stabbed the knife in her neck.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Jen,
you got a thanks for the review, though.
Yeah. Appreciate it. At least it wasn't a one star. Could be worse.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what? Can I just tell you?
Yeah. Doesn't matter. It's either one or all. You know what I mean? That's what
Tell you the truth, the reviews don't even technically
don't say
bother
that
me.
Because then you're going to get a don't you even care? Remember, you got that one time.
Oh, yeah.
Because you
were we
like
care it. About our reviews. We really do. But when you don't leave any critical feedback or constructive feedback, I should say. It doesn't do any good. All you're doing is spouting.
Tell us so we can fix it.
Yeah.
Right?
Let us know. It's all good. We get it. We're not perfect.
I mean, obviously, we make a lot of money off this podcast. We're both.
Oh, my God. We are so rolling in the dough. I'm going to take the girls and I'm going to go buy them a fountain soda at the gas station.
You go,
girl. Just to splurge.
You go. You go. See, I can't do it. I'm not there yet. I can't. Mm-mm. But. Hopefully one day, Jen. Hopefully one day.
Yeah.
All right, girl. What do you got for us? Let's hear it.
It's not about the money. You know, it's not about the money. It's about us doing something.
I know, but I think sometimes
we enjoy.
Think we're professional and we just play one on this podcast and we don't do it very well.
We've never once claimed that we were logical, smart, or
professional.
We've never claimed anything. We just claimed that we have a podcast. That's all we've got. To be quite. That's all we got. This podcast.
Barely holding on to that at that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Whatever. All right. Well, today we are going to be discussing a listener request. Our listener, Katie Roberts, suggested this. This horrific event happened in 1994 in her hometown of Hartlepool.
Oh, yikes.
Hartlepool is a port town in County Durham in northeast England. Founded in the 7th century, Hartlepool in Old English means, can you guess, a place where the deer come to drink. Now, in the Middle Ages, the main industry of the town was fishing, and it established itself as one of the primary ports upon the England's eastern coast. Today, the main employer is Hartlepool Nuclear Power Station. I think they employ 1% of the town.
Wow.
And although the maritime industry still plays a big part of its economy and as well as the center of its tourism. Now, fun fact, I kind of love this because England and other countries besides the U.S. have a rich history, right?
Yes.
From what I've read, at one point in time, and I believe they still are, the townspeople were called monkey hangers.
What? Why?
Legend has it that during the Napoleonic Wars, a French ship wrecked off the coast of Hartlepool. So the French were the enemies, remember?
Mm-hmm.
The only survivor that made it to shore was a monkey. Now, the monkey was supposedly dressed in a French uniform, they say, to keep the sailors on the ship amused. The good folks of Hartlepool had never seen a monkey before, nor had they ever seen anyone from France. So the monkey, I'm guessing, was very upset and was screeching, and the town folk mistakenly thought the sound coming from the monkey was the language of the enemy, like he was speaking French.
Mm-hmm.
So the good folks of Hartlepool put the monkey on trial right there on the beach, and since he couldn't answer any of their questions, he was sentenced to death and hanged right on the spot.
Mm.
So that's the legend. Now, some people don't really believe that this happened, that it's just a folktale. In fact, I think there is a Scottish song that's about the same thing. But some historians said that if it did happen, and, you know, if it really did happen, one of the people or one of the spots on the ship were young boys that used to carry the gunpowder during the battle, mm-hmm. and they were called powder monkeys. So it's gross, but, you know, maybe it was one of the boys, and it just over time, the song got changed to the boy and the monkey, you know. Either way, most of Hartlepool has taken with this legend and ran with it. There are some that still absolutely hate it and think it's horrible. They don't want to be reminded of it. But there are statues of the monkey all around town, or of a monkey, I should say. There's one in the Hartlepool Marina that actually has a charity box collection where the money is used to go to hospice. And Hartlepool United Football Club, their mascot is a monkey that they named. Are you ready? Hangus.
Oh, I was going to say Hardy.
Okay. No. Hangus. That's right. H apostrophe Angus. It's funny. Oh. Hangus.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah, now you do. So, funny fact, Hangus, the mascot, actually ran for mayor of the town in 2002. And he used the election slogan, "Free bananas for school children."
Oh, did he win?
He did win, not only once, but he was reelected twice. So he served three terms, But of course, the mascot didn't actually, he wasn't the mayor, but the man in the monkey suit actually was, and his name was Stuart Drummond.
Hmm.
So I thought that was a little fun little fact. Never heard the story before.
Nor have I.
Anyway, you ready to get down to it?
I sure am. I'm ready.
All right. Beverly Francis and Martin Palmer had met and married in Bristol in 1989. By August 1st of 1990, they brought in a little girl whom they named Rose Francis into the world. Unfortunately, their marriage didn't last much longer after little Rosie's birth, and Beverly moved back to her hometown of Hartlepool, about 275 miles north of Bristol. Although there was quite a distance between them, Martin would still make the 4.5-hour trip one way just to visit Rosie every few weeks.
Aww.
A bit less than 2 years later, Beverly met a man by the name of John Thornton, and by December of 1993, they expanded the family to four by bringing another little girl into the world. The family lived in the Hartlepool borough of Headland, and in a quiet cul-de-sac on Henrietta Street. The people in the neighborhood were very close, and the neighborhood was considered very safe to children to play outside. At 3 years old, Rosie was a happy child. She loved her little sister, and she loved swimming, and she loved ice cream. On June 30th, 1994, John Thornton picked up Rosie from her preschool. Rosie normally played with the neighborhood kids after school, usually the backyard of one of her friends' houses, and today was no different. Around 3:30, 3-year-old Rosie comes to John because she hears the sweet melody of the ice cream van. I mean, seriously, who doesn't feel the call of the ice cream van?
Thank you.
You know, you gotta love that sound. Every time I hear it, it just, I perk up, right?
It went past our house last night, and I asked my kids, who are teenagers, "You want mommy to go get you some ice cream?"
No, my kids, well, they're 12 and 14. They still go crazy, and they'll run, "Mom, I need money!" And then they'll go out. Or they'll take their own money and they'll go out and they'll bring back like 3 or 4 different items and keep them in the freezer. And then if one of them, "You took my ice cream." Yeah, it's fun.
Well,
girls are fun.
That ice cream, you can't get that everywhere. That's why it's cool.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, John gives her money for her treat and sends her on her way. The van's only about 40 yards away from the house. 2 hours later, John realizes that Rosie is no longer at her friend's house, and she's not home either. Frantic, Beverly and John begin to search the area. They called on neighbors and friends, but no sign of Rosie. By 8:45, the police were called. 80 police officers and over 100 volunteers searched the streets, and they searched outbuildings and sheds looking for Rosie. The ice cream man was interviewed, and he remembered seeing Rosie. He knew her not only for her bright red hair, her blue bespectacled eyes, and her cheerful disposition, but she was a regular, and she was the only customer in the area that day. In fact, he remembered her because she was short on money, but he gave her the treat anyway. What police will later find out is that by 4:30, a man who was incredibly drunk had been on a two-day bender. He had walked into a shop to buy some cider. The shopkeeper saw the man had blood on his hand. When he asked what happened, the man drunkenly replied that his dog bit him. And although the shopkeeper didn't exactly see any wounds on the man, he let it go. The intoxicated man then went on to say that he was going to, quote, look for that girl that had vanished, which struck the shopkeeper as odd since he hadn't heard anything about a missing girl. Once the man got out of the shop, he staggered down toward the beach with his dog, and he spent a few hours running in and out of the sea before the police told him to go home. The following morning, with still no sign of Rosie, her mother, Beverly, went to the media to beg anyone that had her daughter to please let her go. Quote, I just want my little girl back. She's only 3, and if someone has got her, please let her go. If anyone knows where she is, or if someone has seen her, please tell the police, I beg you. 3 years old, cute little girl, freckles, flame red hair. Later the same day, officers went door to door asking the local residents to answer questions trying to trace Rosie's last whereabouts. The Coast Guards combed the shorelines and rocky cliffs. Sunderland Lifeboats, which is a charity search and rescue lifeboat service, along with volunteer fishing vessels, searched the sea to find Rosie without any luck. The next day, the police went back to the neighborhood and did searches on a voluntary basis. But by this time, everyone had accepted the fact that Rosie just hadn't wandered away. She had been abducted. On the third day of scouring the neighborhood, two experienced detectives who happened to be in the area spoke to a man by the name of Sean Anthony Armstrong. They had spoken with him the two previous days, and he had been very cooperative, friendly, and helpful. This time, they noted, his demeanor had completely changed. He was, quote, very shifty, on edge, and looking very worried. His appearance was disheveled, which he blamed on heavy drinking while celebrating his birthday. But the change in Armstrong's behavior made them do a background check on him. And what they found gave them sufficient suspicion to have him arrested for further questioning. So let's look back on this man, shall we? Sean Anthony Armstrong, known to everybody in the area as Tony the Pervert. No joke.
Not a nickname you want.
No. Was born in 1962. To an 8-year-old unmarried woman named Rachel in Easington County, Durham, which is about 15 miles from Hartlepool. Sean's father was Rachel's own father. He was a product of incest. Mm. Mm. The first 3 years of Sean's life were spent being raised by his grandparents due to either Rachel working or the fact that she was in and out of psychiatric hospitals. Rachel seemed to develop her mental problems in her early teens, which, surprise, that was about the time that her father's sexual abuse started to become a regular occurrence.
Oh.
When Sean was 3, Rachel married a nice man by the name of George. He was 15 years older than she was, and the man took Sean in and actually gave him his surname. When Sean was 7 years old, his best friend was killed in a road accident. And that's when Sean really started to act out. He is even quoted as saying, quote, I became a bastard. I became hateful and got mad at everyone. He was sent to a child therapist, but it really didn't help. About a month after his friend's death, Sean claims he was sexually abused by his mother. This continued until he was 13 years old. And then he said it progressed to full sexual intercourse, which took place off and on until he was 16. Nearly half a year later, Sean's mother and stepfather separated, and he and his mother went to her parents' home again. George said he tried to be a father to Sean still and to help guide him. You know, even though he was pudgy, he was a little loner, he was an odd kid. But Sean bit the hand that fed him. George had been saving up for a vacation to Blackpool, and Sean stole that money from George.
And how old was he at this time?
It's really unsure.
So he's like a teenager, kind of?
I'm thinking he's a teenager, like 16 or 17.
Okay.
Years old. And he stole the equivalent of, I think, £1,000 around, okay, somewhere around there. Now, he did try to go to the police, but there was nothing the police could do. Nothing ever went about it. So George talked Sean into going into the Royal Navy, hoping that it would make a man out of him, right? Sometimes the military does really shape people up. My husband's ex-Air Force, and he swears by the military. Anyway, I digress. So Sean did go into the Royal Navy, but he was sent home before basic training even finished. Sean claimed that he was psychologically unfit to serve in the Navy, and this was allegedly due to stress following the death of his girlfriend that he dated, supposedly, for over 2 years. He claimed she had passed from cervical cancer at the age of 17. I keep saying allegedly and supposedly is because Sean's a dirty little liar.
Just get that right out there. Okay.
Just going to say it. Okay. So I've typed alleged and allegedly and supposedly so many times during this that I'm like, I really need a thesaurus. Anyway. Sean married a woman who was 8 years older than he was. She had children from a previous relationship, a daughter who was 7, and a son aged 4. Sean got a job in the coal mines. Everything was running fine. In January 1982, Sean was charged and convicted of theft. He was sentenced to 120 hours of community service. Later that same year, his wife would divorce him, citing domestic violence, her discovering that Sean was having sexual intercourse with his natural mother, and only much later, she didn't claim this now, she would claim that he was, quote, what, allegedly sexually abusing her daughter.
Okay.
Soon after the divorce, Sean would try to commit suicide by overdosing on his mother's antidepressants. He was admitted to the hospital in Hartlepool, where he spent 2 days. He did speak with a psychiatrist, but no follow-up appointments were made when he was discharged.
Now, see, that's not okay.
Mm-mm. In 1983, Sean had 2 more appearances before the court for offenses of deception and dishonesty. Now, I'm kind of unsure what this means exactly, but I believe it's some kind of fraud charges, like he was conning people for money.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
I would agree.
He was fined and sentenced to 3 months in jail, but this sentence was suspended for 2 years. So basically, he was on parole, right?
So, yeah, he didn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
He got nothing.
In May 1984, Sean's marriage was officially over, and his response? Slash both of his arms in an apparent attempt to kill himself again. He was sent back to the hospital, but they only stitched him up. They didn't delve into his mental health issues at all. Less than 3 weeks after attempting to take his life for the second time, Sean was sentenced to 3 months imprisonment for 4 offenses of dishonesty. So I'm guessing he broke that parole. After his short jail stint, Sean went back to work in the coal mines. And then in November, he started dating a woman who was 17 years older. And not only was she a divorced alcoholic mother of 4, in other words, she was a keeper, she was friends with Sean's mother. He, of course, started drinking heavily. There's some talk of drug use.
Mm-hmm.
So after starting this relationship, Sean attacked his own mother, and he ended up being charged with, quote, assault occasioning actual bodily harm, which means he hurt somebody with the intent to hurt somebody, is what I believe that means. He was also charged with 5 offenses of dishonesty, but that was unrelated to the assault. So in court, Sean claimed that the only reason why he assaulted his mom is that she had just told him that he was a product of incest, that his father was actually his grandfather. But like I said, it's unclear if that's true or not, if that's the reason why he really attacked her. Sean only received 160 hours of community service. Sean's doctor admitted him into the hospital and diagnosed him with depression and put him on antidepressants. And he was soon released, and once again, no appointment was made for follow-up.
I'm speechless with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, for the next 5 years, Sean was in and out of court and jail, and he lost his job. So now we're up to 1989. Sean was out on parole. Within 8 months of being on parole and out of prison, he was remarried, and all seemed to be going well.
Mm-hmm.
By March of 1990, Sean's doctor had him go see a clinical psychiatrist. Sean shared his past with the psychiatrist, and the doctor told him that he could and would help him. But Sean never showed up to any more appointments. Sean continued to drink heavily and was soon back in court for theft, and he was fined $60. By 1991, Sean tried to sober up, and he attended AA meetings, and within a month, he was back in court for theft again. This time, he was only fined $100. Are you seeing a theme here?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think this was like 1960, and it's not. Okay, go ahead.
No, they just keep slap on the wrist, slap on the wrist, slap on the wrist. So his doctor admitted him once again to a hospital. Now, Sean loved the attention and sympathy that he could garner from the staff. He would lie to the nursing staff, saying that he received a dishonorable discharge from the Royal Navy for shooting a petty officer. And then he would say that he was a veteran of the Falkland Wars. Or he would complain how he caught his wife in bed with another man, and then he threw that man out the window. And then, you know, oh my God, my life's so miserable. I'm always fighting with my stepson. My stepdaughter is always going out drinking every night, and I have to care for my wife's little babies. You know, they were aged 2 and 3 mm-hmm, at the time. Mm-hmm. He would say and do anything to get attention from the staff. They diagnosed him with a personality disorder, and Sean was discharged from the hospital in April of 1991. And once he was discharged, he went back to live with that cheating wife, which there's really no proof that she cheated on him. But Sean's marriage would only last another 7 months. His wife would throw him out after her daughters claimed that he had sexually abused them. That one of those daughters actually also claimed that Sean sexually abused another family member who was just 2 years old.
Ugh.
Now, supposedly this happened during bath time. Sean asked the two-year-old to, quote, suck his tail. But the child refused to do so as, quote, it was naughty.
Would a two-year-old even know that? I don't know if they would.
I don't know. I would hope.
No, I mean, I think that they would know that, you know, because you're supposed to teach them what your privates are early on or whatever. But I don't know. Like, two's pretty young still, you know? All right,
two's very young. Both police and social services interviewed all of the alleged victims, but there was no other evidence against Sean. It was he said, she said type situation. Social services decided that since Sean was no longer staying in the home and his wife was not allowing him any contact with the children, that there shouldn't be any further issues. However, the social worker did write at the bottom of the case paper saying he, meaning Sean, is likely to be a risk to any child he comes into contact with.
You think?
Mm-hmm. After this, Sean started heavily drinking and doing drugs just to cope with these allegations. But police and social workers dropped the charges, or didn't even drop the charges because there were no charges. Actually, they weren't even going to file charges. And once again, he was remitted into the hospital. So unfortunately, no one told the hospital about Sean's abuse allegations. And later, the reason being is they said that they didn't inform a doctor of the abuse allegations because they saw it that it could be a breach of confidentiality. another place I read that he did tell a doctor that he liked to hurt children, or he had fantasies about children or something. But I only found that in one spot, so I can't say if that's true or not. So during the next 9 months, Sean was in and out of the hospital 4 more times due to suicide attempts. In fact, it's said that he had done at least 17 suicide attempts in his life so far. In the last attempt, he arrived at the hospital unconscious because he had taken upwards of 50 antidepressants and sedatives. When he was admitted, he told the staff that he intended to kill his girlfriend and then kill himself. So this last time, Sean was in the hospital for 8 weeks. And since he didn't have a place to live after his release, his consultant wrote a letter to Hartlepool Council outlining his need for housing. The housing council is basically like, I'm thinking Section 8 housing. Like, yeah, he's desperate. Probably. He needs somebody to, yeah. So that letter snagged him a house at 51 Frederick Street in Hartlepool, a first floor council flat, only 108 feet or 33 meters from where sweet little Rosie lived. 6 months after he was discharged from the hospital, Sean attended an outpatient clinic. He showed much improvement in his general health. He claimed that he had recently started to work in a shoe shop, he'd purchased his car, and he had stopped drinking and doing drugs.
Hmm.
Okay. So now we're up to date to where Sean is, right?
Yep.
Sean decided to celebrate his 32nd birthday by drinking for 2 solid days at
right after
people's.
You said that he just got clean. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly. 2 solid days he went on a bender, and he was drinking at different people's houses and pubs and clubs. And on June 30th, 1994, he was at a club on Stewart Street, which is about a mile or so from his house, where he drank 6 pints of beer and several large rums. At approximately 3:20 p.m., Sean took a taxi to his home. When he got out of the taxi, he heard the sweet call of the ice cream van. Now, Sean watched the street looking for children. He soon spotted 3-year-old Rosie, dressed in red and white checkered shorts and a white t-shirt with a daisy motif. Moments later, Sean lured the sweet toddler into his flat where she was raped and murdered.
Mm-hmm.
So at 7:30 p.m. on July 3rd, 1994, police pull up to Sean's apartment at 51 Frederick Street. Sean saw them coming and ran, but the police dogs took him down, and he was arrested and brought into the station for questioning. When the officers searched Sean's flat, they found Rosie's mutilated body in a trash bag inside an airing cupboard in the apartment. Now, an airing cupboard could be a closet where you keep the water heaters kept, or a linen closet, or it could actually be a cabinet. I couldn't find the actual definition to what it is.
I'm sure somebody will let us know.
Mm-hmm. Her underwear and red and white checkered shorts were found nearby in a separate bag. Sean, of course, denied any involvement of the crime and claimed that, quote, someone else must have put that body in there. Wonder.
That's weird. Who would ever get in there and do that?
A pathologist who examined Rosie's tiny body reported that it showed signs of an extremely violent and sustained sexual attack, and that they estimated that she had died within an hour after she had been taken. Although he couldn't be sure of the exact cause of death because of the decomposition. On July 12, 1994, Rosie was laid to rest. Over 1,000 people gathered outside the service to listen as the service was played over a loudspeaker. On Henrietta Street, where Rosie lived, the sidewalk was filled with flowers, teddy bears, and cards. She was actually everybody's child at that point, and everybody came. And in fact, once Sean was arrested, he was completely mobbed. The townspeople of Hartlepool wanted blood.
Yeah, so would I.
Mm-hmm. And on top of Rosie's hearse was a floral arrangement, and supposedly it was made into the shape of a rocking horse. And the arrangement was from the inmates at the Holm House Men's Prison. And I also only found that in one spot, but I really desperately want it to be true. So that's what I include. I included it in here. Yeah.
Nope. I would.
While in police custody, Sean planned to cite mental illness and to plead guilty of manslaughter on grounds of diminished responsibility. He thought he'd just get away with a couple years.
Again.
That's what he was planned.
Mm-hmm. Well, he never got anything ever, so I can't blame him.
Mm-hmm.
Probably thought he wouldn't get anything either.
Until he received a letter from an auburn-haired beauty by the name of Lorna Jane Stevens. Dun, dun, dun. Sean quickly fell in love with the dance instructor and through a series of letters confessed to killing Rosie and how he was trying to trick the courts into a lesser sentence. Now, fortunately for Rosie's family and the good folks of Hartlepool, but unfortunately for Sean, Lorna Jane Stevens was actually an author by the name of Bernard O'Mahony.
Oh, you go, Bernie.
Mm-hmm. Bernard turned the letters over to the authorities, and the rest is history. On July 27th, 1995, Sean Anthony Armstrong pleaded guilty to the murder of Little Rosie and sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 16 years before he could be eligible for parole. But we're not done. In 1997, Rosie's mom filed a lawsuit against the Tees Health Authority and the Hartlepool and East Durham NHS Trust, alleging negligence for allowing Sean to be released from their care. The suit was dropped in 1998 since Sean hadn't made any direct threat to Rosie or her family. In 2001, Sean was granted legal aid to sue Bernard O'Mahony for breach of confidence, it astounds me that he's put away for a murder of a three-year-old and he's given legal aid to go after.
Mm-hmm.
That astounds me, but that's neither here or there.
Mm.
Sean also tried to stop him from publishing his book, Flowers in the Garden, but the suit was dropped. And to tell you the truth, that's where I got most of this information from. From Bernard O'Mahony's book, Flowers in the Garden.
There's Bernie.
Couple chapters of him. So Sean was up for parole in 2010 because he was sentenced to 16 years minimum, right? And 16 years, 2010. Rosie's mother launched a campaign to make sure Sean's name would be placed on the sex offenders register if he ever got paroled. Now, this is where it gets sad. The Sex Offenders Register in the UK was established in 1997. Sean wasn't convicted until 95, I believe, is what I said. Sean, even though he did rape Little Rosie, was only charged with murder. He was never charged for raping her.
Why? Because she was too decomposed?
They have their reasons, is what they said.
Okay.
Right. And so he would never be on the register. If he would get out, he would never be on the register.
Mm-hmm.
And Beverly tried to appeal this rule, but lost. And as far as I can tell, Sean, or Tony the pervert, as we'd like to call him, is still locked away in prison.
Good.
I can't even find what prison he's in.
He needs to stay there forever and ever.
I'm surprised he hasn't been killed in prison, to be quite honest. Seriously.
Maybe him.
I mean, that's pretty... 3 years old? Come on. The court said that he would only be released if the parole board was satisfied that he no longer posed any risk to the public. And it doesn't seem that that would ever happen. And a former member of the Rosie Palmer Foundation, Mr. Kevin Kelly, stated that if he ever came back to Hartlepool, he would be lynched. Yes.
Positive of it. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
There's no doubt in my mind. I'd help. So that's the poor little story of
sweet little Rosie.
The murder of little Rosie.
You know, I know child abuse is a cycle, and I know usually abusers have themselves been abused. But he should have been put away even before he got to Rosie. You know what I mean?
He completely fell through the cracks each and every time. I really don't know the laws. I barely know the laws of the United States, much less anything overseas. But you would think, how many times does the guy get a small fine for
just
being charged with theft?
With it. Yeah. Everything, though. He just kept getting away from it, getting away with it. It's like somebody needed to step up and say, this person is troubled. They need help. They can't just be out there, you know?
Right. And they are completely correct. I mean, when Rosie's mom tried to sue the NHS and the medical authorities and all those people, their hands were tied. He never made a direct threat. I mean, if he had made a direct threat, they could have stopped it. But I mean, you can't predict. You can say all the crap you want to say. Doesn't mean you're actually going to do it.
Right.
I don't know. It's a horrible, sad situation. And I'm very sorry that Beverly and her parents or any parents have to go through that kind of hole in the system.
Anyway, that was a good case, and I commend our reader suggestion. That was good.
Yes, Katie, thank you very much. Like I said, there wasn't a lot of information out there, the same story over and over and over again. The book Flowers in God's Garden by Bernard O'Mahony gave a little bit more information. But like I said, the only thing I was able to find was half of a court document for the lawsuit that Beverly put on the NHS, mm-hmm. and that was only half.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you did well, Jen, minus the pronunciation of consonants. Consonants, vowels.
I hereby declare that all consonants to be... See, I can't even say it. Can't even say consonants. They should be illegalized. Mm-hmm. Illegalized, that's not even a word, but I'm going to make that a word. That's my next executive order.
I like it. I like it. Yeah. All right, Jen, do we have any promos?
We do have a promo. This week's promo is by the New West Radio Theater. So give them a listen.
Very good. And until then, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
And stay away from consonants. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Jen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all Our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at wetalkofdreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya. Now, Hartlepool is a... Blah, 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 blah. Volunteer fishing vessel. Fish. That's a lot to say.
It's got some S's in there.
It does.
Fisting vessel.
Sunderland lifeboats. La la la. Sibbit, 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 sibbit. She had been abducted. She had been abducted. I don't know what adducted is. It sounds like a math term.
Then you take the adduction over here and you're going to put adduction. It in with
The denominator. Yeah.
Is that like the Terminator?
Kind of, because it's math. On the third day of scouring the neighborhood, two experienced detectives.
the detectives, are they looking into the what'd you call it?
Abducted.
Okay.
Okay. Just so everybody knows, my tongue is kind of swelling just on the left hand side. I've taken meds.
How'd you do that, Jen?
I have no idea. I'm allergic to something. Sometimes my lip swells, but I've been to the doctor for it. They have no idea. I've done, whatchamacallit. See, I'm even brain dead today. I've done allergy tests. The only thing that came back that said is I'm allergic to cats. I've had cats all of my life and never had a problem. We don't know what causes it, but something's causing it. So my tongue's kind of swelling up. Yeah, because I've seen you. I think the last time I saw you was last summer, maybe. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So my tongue is swelling up. I'm going to use that as an excuse, and you can't stop me from using that as an excuse.
I got you.
But this time, they noted that his Demeter had complete... That his Demeter...
You're having hard problems with the D's today.
It's or any consonant.
It's just frozen tongue.
It's pretty much any consonant, to be quite honest. Okay. The vowels, I'm fine. I can handle those five vowels. It's the 21 other letters that I'm having a problem with. And stay away from consonants.
Totally.
Or did I say continents? I don't know.
It doesn't matter. Consonants.
Yeah. It doesn't even sound right now, does it?
Continents. No.
Continents. Continent. Yeah. Consonant. No.
Whatever.
Vowels. Consonants. Yeah. It doesn't sound right.
Just talk real good.
See ya.
Bye.
New West Radio Theater. Paying homage to old-time radio shows and creating new audio fiction for the 21st century. New West Radio Theater. New West Radio Theater. Weebly.com.